Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of items either made from recycled materials or are recyclable, like shopping bags, bag clips, and key tags. Information on their Go Green catalog can be found at trophytime.com. They're more than just trophies.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Celeste Quinn today. Jason Croft is our technical director. The following interview is from the AM 580 archives. It is pre-recorded, so no phone calls can be taken this hour.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 online at will.illinois.edu, W-I-L-L.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Glad you could be with us today. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the story of a physician whose life offers us a lens through which to view American society, culture, and politics in the 19th century. Her story also provides us with some perspective of the debates of our day. Her name, Mary Putnam Jacobi. In the 19th century, a battle raged over the woman question. Many men in medicine argued that education threatened the health of women. Mary Putnam Jacobi, who was born in 1842 and died in 1906, worked to prove them wrong. She argued that social restrictions, not biology, threatened women's health, that women benefited from education, mental engagement, and physical activity. Our guest this afternoon is historian Carla Biddle. She is the author of Mary Putnam Jacobi and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call or with an email message. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Carla Biddle is an associate professor of history at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. Her book, Mary Putnam Jacobi and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Biddle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Celeste. Good to be here.
So your introduction begins with another physician of the time, a fellow by the name of Edward H. Clark. Who was he?
Edward Clark was a physician at Harvard University, and he wrote a book published in 1873 called Sex in Education, or A Fair Chance for the Girls. And Clark's book set off really a firestorm of debate in the United States and in Britain about coeducation, about whether girls could be educated in the same way as boys, and whether young women should dare go to college alongside men. And the book sparked a lot of debate, and women's rights activists responded, and Jacobi was one of the loudest voices.
Yeah. How influential was that book, Clark's book, Sex and Education?
The book was very very influential among physicians and widely read, although, as I said, very, very much debated. But his ideas, he was not alone in these ideas. He reflected a broader sense that women were very different than men. And this is what historians refer to often as the sexual science of the 19th century, which is of great interest to me. As experts in the 19th century use science to describe what made men and women different, and according to physicians like Clark, what made them so different. And Clark had great influence.
I want to ask, I've got one more question here, then I'm going to take a call. We've already got someone wanting to talk with us.
Okay.
But, you know, as biography and history, this story is very interesting. You did a wonderful job telling this story. But how is it relevant to our time?
Well, you know, to be honest, I actually didn't really think I would write a biography in the beginning. And I started to read more about Mary Putnam Jacobi and read her writings, and I was caught and wanted to pursue her further. But she also had great relevance to me for our own time, because I think her life and work raises questions that we're still grappling with. Questions about, for example, does the gender of your physician matter in healthcare? If you have a woman or a male physician, do they treat differently, or do they, you know, treat people the same? It also raises questions about the nature of sex differences, which has been a great debate in the last a few decades. And even recently, there's a great deal of literature out about what makes women's brains different than men's.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that literature is positive, and some of it is a little questionable. So I think that this raises a lot of questions we're still grappling with.
Yeah. Next month, I hope to talk with a neuroscientist by the name of Elise Elliott. She's the author of a new book, Pink Brain, Blue Brain.
Yes.
And, you know, we've come to accept that boys can't focus in a classroom and girls are obsessed with relationships because that's just the way they're built. But
mm-hmm.
Elliott says, well, there are subtle differences in the brains of boys and girls. Overall, those brains are remarkably alike and are heavily shaped by learning. She says our brains are what we do with them.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
it's here we have, you know, we're still arguing about this.
Exactly.
Or thinking about it.
And there's, you know, literature in the opposite argument, too, about that we should accept that they're different and see that as an advantage. You know, but this issue of difference and similarity, I think, is very complicated.
Let's take that call now from a listener in Indiana, line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. This, unfortunately, it's just like reliving the civil rights movement all over again in some ways. I was lucky enough to be raised in a community where I had access to black children who I played with. Me and another guy bonded very well for years. And I also come across a couple of girls who could beat my buns running from anywhere to anywhere. So I came out of that grade school experience with a lot different attitude about girls and blacks, for example. And what's always I found peculiar is what was the philosophical background or reasoning for some of these guys to make these statements. I know now we can, you know, check things like, you know, the pink brain or the blue brain, all that sort of stuff. And, you know, that's just blood flow. But what was it that made them buy into this stuff, especially physicians who, you know, should have had some sense at that time. But while I read in the literature, nobody seemed to have any. Everybody just shook their heads up and down. That's right. The girls can't do that. You know, even when they did it, you know, that's what always just surprised me. I sure hope you keep up this kind of stuff. It's very interesting programs you've been having lately. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call. Carla Biddle, you want to comment?
Sure. As I understand the question, it's really about where was Clark coming from and why did some physicians argue that not only were girls and young women different, but that they were also the implication is that they were inferior in many ways, that their bodies were essentially weaker, essentially more fragile, and that if they studied too much, they would be at risk for illness and even sterility. So, you know, these are pretty serious descriptions, and that were taken very seriously at the time. So why did they argue this? And I think, you know, it's the science of the sexual science of the time was very much reflective of how people socially understood the relationships between men and women, and how the type of historical construction of womanhood that was happening in the Victorian era. It was very much, I think the science of the time was very much interrelated to the politics of the time. Mm.
Mary Putnam earned two medical degrees, and one of her MDs was earned in France, and her first application to that school was rejected. How did she gain entry?
Well, yes, she is very notable for being the first woman admitted to the École de Médecine in Paris. And she goes to Paris at age 24 after receiving a pharmacy degree in the United States and then also her first MD in at the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And she goes to Paris seeking, like many men did at the time, actually seeking to expand her medical education. Paris was seen as the center of the medical universe and especially the School of Medicine there. And she went, again, knowing that this was going to be a difficult task, but very much hoping she could get access to the clinics and, even more importantly, the laboratories of Paris. And I think she gained access for a few reasons. One is that, and I'll say three main reasons. One is that she certainly had some personal and professional connections in Paris. She had connections to physicians who could introduce her to other physicians. Also, her father, who was a famous publisher, and I can talk more about him too, had also connections there. But I think even more importantly, it was a time of transition in the Second Empire in France at the time. The last few years of the reign of Napoleon III, it was a time of reform, and the government in some ways was responding to demands for the expansion of education. So you had a minister of education by the name of Victor Dury, who was very sympathetic to women's education, and he was able to essentially be the final word and sign off on her admission. I also think that she occupied a very interesting gender identity in Paris, that she consciously constructed herself and her identity as a foreign woman, as an American woman who was seeking education there. And I think that seemed less threatening in some ways, ultimately, to some of her male peers and the male professors. It was women in France were, it was the justification for refusing their admission to schools of higher education was that this would somehow undo French civilization, that it would make these women less likely to be good mothers, and that it would also in many ways cause some problems in the classroom, that French women would be too tempting for French men as their peers in the classroom. So Jacobi described herself as not beautiful but genteel, saying that she was someone who didn't distract her peers and was very serious, and she was American and had a more cool temperament and therefore could work alongside men with no problem.
At the same time, though, she wrote her parents about her historic achievement, saying there may soon be a petticoat in the school's amphitheater.
Right.
This says that she also had to be careful to present herself as a feminine woman.
Absolutely. And this the use of the phrase, the petticoat physician, is one that's used by other women doctors later as they, another book by a woman doctor called Petticoat Surgeon. And they are trying to, in many ways, maintain their femininity. in the United States, especially women who pursued medicine could be accused of becoming masculine or that they were somehow unsexing themselves by doing men's medical work. And so at the same time, you're absolutely right, she really tried to maintain a feminine, strong character, not a fashionable character, but one that was definitely feminine.
Still see that today, don't we?
Yes, it's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about her family, her family's background, her parents, George and Victorine. George, you mentioned, was in the publishing business. Tell us about the parents.
Yes, and if Mary Putnam Jacoby herself is not familiar to listeners, her father and his business might be, because George Palmer Putnam was the founder of Putnam Publishing in New York, and eventually with his famous office on Broadway. And Putnam Publishing, under his watch, would become one of the most important presses at mid-century in New York and the United States. And he played a vital role in making and building New York as a publishing center. And, of course, that still is with us today in many ways.
Yeah. So Mary was the eldest of 11 children. What were her parents' attitudes about the education of girls?
Well, I think it's a very interesting dilemma for them, because she was very much influenced, I think, by her father and his world. She often described, and other people described her being at the side of her father as he worked with clients, with writers that he was acquiring for his press. And I think he was very encouraging of her education. He recognized that she was a very smart cookie, very precocious at an early age, and he really wanted to foster her education and saw her as a writer, too. She wrote a lot of unpublished and published works as a young woman. But I think he was less certain about her becoming a physician. In fact, he at one time asks her, why do you want to engage in what he described as a, quote, repulsive pursuit? And I think by repulsive, what he meant was that it was very unladylike to think about women having access to bodies during, of course, dissection, but also caring for live patients. That was very sort of intimate work, but also very explicit. And I think he didn't quite understand that, but ultimately was very supportive.
What led her to her pursuit of science?
I think that's also a really interesting question, because I think most people in her family expected her to become a writer, possibly a novelist or a short story writer, essayist, publishing in possibly journals like her father's Putnam's Monthly. But she ultimately chose a life of science, and I explain that in a few ways. I think the most important thing has to do with the fact that she made science her new faith. She had a real struggle with faith as a young woman, and struggled with evangelical conversion and sort of the influence of her grandmother, who really wanted her to become a very avid Baptist. And she struggles with that as a young age, and then she goes on to, even as a young woman, have a hard time with this. And in, at the age of 20, I describe that she had a scientific conversion instead. she in fact converted to science, in a sense, and made science in her new a new faith, and she was not alone in this. Of course, this is a broader process of secularization, I think, that's happening in the 19th century, and there were other people who also started to question faith and look at science as a type of faith at the time. But I think she was more extreme than others. She often described scientific text as if they, you know, as if they demanded the regard of a spiritual text. She saw, as I say, that she had, she saw hospitals as almost temples of health. And she was critical of religion as something she thought was very limiting to women. Now, that was not true for all women. Many women in the early 19th century saw a religion as very empowering. And she starts to see it as limiting. And she sees science as an opportunity, even though, of course, there are many people in the scientific community not welcoming to women. She sees it as a path to advancement.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is historian Carla Biddle. She's the author of Mary Putnam Jacobi and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America. The book offers us a lens through which to view American society, culture, and politics in the 19th century. And the story that is set out in the book also provides us with some perspective of the debates of our day. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Mary Putnam was a young woman during the Civil War. Did that have an impact on her worldview, on the choices she would make in life?
Yes, absolutely. In addition to this, you know, idea of conversion I mentioned, I also think the world around her was changing in such a way that, and especially during the Civil War, that she became very invested in science as a way of science as an outlook on the world. And I think that the Civil War was an important turning point for her. As she read about and read about the, you know, great losses of the Civil War and also studied medicine simultaneously. And I think she sees the real personal human impact of the war when she goes south to the area near New Orleans to take care of her brother, who has become ill. He was, her brother, George Haven Putnam, was in the Union Army serving in the area near New Orleans, and he became ill with malaria, and she went down to nurse him. And I think when on this trip, which was, she did alone, which was pretty gutsy at the time, she went to care for him and really saw the real sacrifices and also tragedy of war, and that caring for the soldiers and also managing health and illness required a new type of medicine. And I think the Civil War was a turning point for that.
She was a little girl when the Declaration of Rights and Sentiments was drafted in Seneca Falls, New York,
right,
in 1848. Would she have been aware of that conference and the document as she grew up?
She was definitely, when she was a young woman, I do know that she was definitely familiar with the work of some of the major women's rights activists, especially Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And I don't have a direct reference to that, mm-hmm, but as someone who was so well-read as a young woman, and her family was so in touch with the reforms of that time, and also so, of course, entrenched in publishing, I think she would have been reading about women's rights activity. And, of course, being in New York City, she was, of course, much of this activity was happening upstate, as you mentioned, but there were still strong connections, and I think she was aware of it.
Yeah, really interesting, because that document is pretty radical for its day.
Absolutely.
And thinking about that, and I'm thinking, well, she was like 6 or 7 years old, maybe in 1848, and I'm, mm-hmm, reading along in your book, and I come along to this sentence. For many years, she was theoretically opposed to women's suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting contradiction to me. Would you talk about that?
Sure. I think he's someone who's full of interesting contradictions. And I say at one point in the book that she may have not been a, quote, model feminist because of some of her views. And she really does not declare publicly a strong allegiance or support of suffrage until the 1890s. So for most of her adult life as a physician slash activist, she saw, I believe, medicine and science, women's education, women in the professions, and women's health as primary political issues. I think she felt like women's health and correcting notions about women's health was the best way to change, make solid changes and help women access the professions and also access college, and that would make a greater difference to her than suffrage at the time.
Hmm. Well, now let's talk about Abraham Jacoby. The year Dr. Clark's book, Claiming Education Wasn't Good for the Health of Women, was published in 1873, Mary Putnam married Abraham Jacoby. Who was he, and how significant was the marriage for the two of them, in particular, I suppose, for her?
He was a very interesting and significant person in the history of medicine and politics. He's known as the father of pediatrics, and both of them were important for this process, but he especially was important for the promotion of pediatrics as a specialty. This is something we take for granted now, that we have a separate sort of set of practitioners who are dedicated to helping children and specialized knowledge on child health. This was not true in the mid-19th century, when children were often treated in similar ways as adults. So he was very important in that movement. And he was also a very interesting person as well. And he was an immigrant from, he came from a German-Jewish background, and he was involved in the revolutions of 1848. In when he became about 18 or 19, and he pursued studies at universities in Prussia, he also began to study medicine and also became active in the political movements at the time, especially those that were both in some ways democratic and also a socialist. And he became a follower of Karl Marx and was ultimately tried at the Cologne Communist Trial for his distribution of literature and activity. So he was quite he was part of the revolutionary movements of 1848. He fled and then went to England and eventually settled in New York to pursue medicine.
Yeah, you know, you would think perhaps maybe that this couple enjoyed what we today call a marriage of partners or of peers, but that wasn't the case. They had very different ideas about managing a household and who was responsible for caring for children.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're a very interesting pair, and I describe their relationship as a medical marriage because in many ways they had a very strong ideological and political union. And for the time, Abraham Jacoby was quite supportive of his wife pursuing medicine, and in some ways was very supportive. However, they also had conflicts surrounding who would take care of the children. Now, they did eventually have servants, but there was a sense that mothers should be very involved in overseeing the care of children, and at times that was a conflict in their marriage.
Mm. You note that they were both promoters of democracy, and they believed that a just society meant equal health and equal living conditions. How did they envision that becoming a reality?
Well, I think they were both involved in working at dispensaries and clinics that served the most needy populations of Manhattan in the late 19th century. And so they often, you know, they dedicated their life to caring for people who needed health care the most. And I think they saw health care as a way to try to ensure, especially for children, that if they had, from a very early age, if their health was insured, if they were protected in that way, that they would, in the future, become what they described as, you know, good citizens, successful citizens, and that that was a pathway to creating a more just society.
What were their views on class and race and immigration?
Yeah, well, I think that's also a very interesting, especially for Abraham Jacoby, who was an immigrant himself, and someone who very much, again, dedicated his life to supporting the working and lower classes of New York and other immigrants in providing health care. And yet at the same time had his own prejudices, I'd say, as did Mary, in a sense. Really, I think that they, you know, especially Abraham towards the later part of his life, was someone who there's a real sense of professional distance that they both develop with their patients, and a sense of, I think they believed in wanting to create a equal society, and that they wanted the genders and they wanted racial equality, and at the same time, they also harbored these feelings of a superiority as well, because they were professionals, and they saw professionals as the leaders, the sort of the vanguard for social change, and in many ways, they had ideas that were common to other reformers at the time.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, historian Carla Biddle, author of Mary Putnam Jacoby and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email messages invited at will-talk@illinois.edu. You say that in the final 25 years of the 19th century, she became arguably the most significant woman physician of her time. And when I read that, I thought, woman physician? So what was her standing in the wider field of medicine?
She really was very well-respected in the field of medicine broadly. And I think that's what is one thing that makes her extremely significant, is that she was very accomplished. She was one of the most educated women physicians of the time. And she was educated more than some of the men who were practicing medicine. And so I think the degree from Paris, and I think there were many things about the way she did medicine that earned her the respect of some other physicians. And one of the reasons I say that she is one of the most important women physicians is that she was one of the loudest voices in the promotion of science and medicine. And today, that's something we really take for granted. We go to the doctor's office, and one of the first things that we might do would be to give blood or to give urine and have some type of analysis done, laboratory analysis done, where the doctor would then get results and would really diagnose and formulate treatment based on laboratory work. This was new in the late 19th century and quite controversial. There were many physicians who believed the best way to treat a patient was really to observe them in the examining room, and that was really the only way to know a patient. But Mary Putnam Jacoby was part of a generation of physicians who really believed that the laboratory and science needed to be integrated into medicine, and that the laboratory was really the key to understanding what was going on inside the body, what could not be seen visibly. And so she's very, her voice in that debate is very strong, and she is often telling not only women physicians they need to be more scientific, but male physicians as well.
Yeah. What would you like to tell us about her research on women's health?
I think her research on women's health is in some ways where this book started. I just found her research and writing so interesting. And at the time, we began by talking about Edward Clark, and there were a lot of medical writers, there were a lot of physicians at the time, not all medical men, who again described women in terms that were not always very flattering, as very different from men, and also described women in terms of their fragility. And Jacoby said the opposite. Basically, she used her scientific knowledge and she used the tools of scientific medicine to illustrate and research and then argue why it is that women were essentially healthy. That she said that women were not inherently pathological, as some were saying, but that they were essentially healthy and capable of the same type of education as men, and that they were healthier when they were active and healthier when they were educated, that physical and mental stimuli were the key to maintaining health. Even more radically, she argued that men and women were not so different. And this is her take on sexual science of the time. She said men and women were not polar opposites, as some physicians were describing, that they were very similar. And she used that to argue for the expansion of women's place in the public sphere.
What were the views of the day regarding women and physical exertion?
There was a lot of literature and a lot of discussion at the time, and I think quite a bit of debate. And again, in the kind of echoing Edward Clark, there were physicians who really believed that women, particularly during menstruation, should rest, that they should sort of away from any sort of stressful situations, especially during menstruation. They felt that that would keep women most healthy for reproduction. And Jacoby said the opposite. She said that, you know, women needed to maintain a continuous regimen of exercise. And she was supported, she provided the science behind that, but she was supported very much by women who were active in some of the first women's colleges who were promoting physical exercise and sports for women at that time. So it was very much debated, and she provided the science that said women should remain active. And really what she was doing in some ways was fighting science with science. That's one of the chapter titles of my book. She was providing an alternative view of the body with scientific evidence. And she really saw herself as an activist, but she also really believed that this was the truth, that she was being the most objective on this question, even though, as I say, you can see that her own science reflected her gender politics as well.
Would it be fair to say that she took us a long way toward depathologizing menstruation?
Absolutely, absolutely. And she because I think her voice in challenging Clark really allowed for women to follow in her footsteps, and women in different fields. So you have women physicians who follow, who do studies on menstruation. You have some women psychologists later on who are interested in some of these questions. And I think that she was very important. And it didn't happen overnight. I mean, certainly even into the early 20th century, there are still a lot of ideas alive and well about the fact that menstruation was seen as sort of an illness. but or something that really weakened women, that they needed to be cared for as if it were an illness. But she I think, was an important turning point.
Yeah. I would say that well into the 20th century, it's been an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And even you even hear, you know, I think today it's as much as it has been normalized, I do think it's still a very interesting question. I think when some people read my book, that something I think interesting they bring up is they say, well, Jacoby said that women didn't need to rest during menstruation, but sometimes I feel like I need a rest. So she said, you know, go out and do whatever you're supposed to do. And I've had several colleagues joke about that.
Yeah. Well, there's the, you know, that's what it is. It's about what you choose to do,
mm-hmm.
And what you feel like doing. And so there you have it. Did she... You said that she did a lot in terms of proving that women and men were on an equal footing intellectually. How did she go about making that case?
She made that case in a few different ways, but the case was very much made on physiological grounds, actually. And in this effort to show that women were not, that if women were active mentally, that they would remain healthy. And she did all sorts of laboratory testing on blood and urine. And she also had women do exercise, and then she would use an instrument to trace their pulse. And she would show the ways in which exercise really was a stimulant for women and how that helped them physically. So much of her research was physiological as related to the brain, which I think is very much of this time period. That will, of course, change at the dawn of the 20th century, but it's very much physiological and neurological at the time.
How comfortable would she be today in the classroom, the laboratory, a clinic?
I think she would be very pleased with the growth of women in medicine. Now, I think when she died in 1906, the numbers of women in medicine had grown, and I think she was pleased at the time. However, they do, between about 1920 and 1970, the numbers don't grow. Women remain about 5 to 7% of the population of physicians in the United States. It's really in the 1970s, after the women's movement, the women's health movement, and the expansion of women in medical school, that you see the numbers go up quite a bit. And I think she would be happy with that today. I think she might be baffled by the fact that we are still debating the relationship, the content, or the role of sex differences. This issue we began with. I think she'd be a little baffled that we hadn't figured this out. For her, it was so clear, but I think it's she'd be baffled that we're still debating what make men and women different, and that's. You know, a scientific question and also a social one for us.
Yeah. It would be, I'm picturing her now in her petticoat, having a talk with Lawrence Summers at Harvard.
Oh, yes.
Well,
yes, I think she'd have a few questions for him and comments.
Yeah. What about her, at the end of her life, if I'm recalling correctly, it was a brain tumor that ultimately took her life. Cost her life. And at the end of her life, she was working on cancer?
Actually, she did study brain tumors in the 1880s. So brain, you know, it's ironic and of course tragic that she spent years in the 1880s studying brain tumor and trying to understand the relationship between tumors and nervous disease. That wasn't really, because sometimes the symptoms overlapped, and it was very unclear to neurologists what was going on there. So they were, you know, she wrote a few papers on the nature of brain tumors, and then ultimately she she died of one, and I juxtapose those writings with her own case report. She wrote a narrative of her own symptoms, which is simultaneously scientific and distant, as if she were an observer, and also very personal, describing what it felt like to struggle with this disease. And so the case report is a fascinating piece of evidence.
Yeah. There must have been quite a good deal of progress from the time she started in medicine as a young woman, when medicine really didn't know what the spleen was all about until the end of her life.
There was, and especially she lived through a real expansion, again, of science and medicine and, you know, one of the most important things, the bacteriological revolution, and which was, when bacteriology was first introduced, it was very much debated. There were physicians who had a hard time believing that disease was being spread by something we just really couldn't see, or except under the microscope. But she was someone who believed in bacteriology early on, and I think was you know pleased to see that that had become accepted knowledge by the end of the 19th century.
Yeah. There, we'll leave it. We're out of time.
Okay.
Carla Biddle, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Carla Biddle is an associate professor of history at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. She is the author of Mary Putnam Jacoby and the Politics of Medicine in 19th Century America. The book is published by the University of North Carolina Press.
You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives here on The Afternoon Magazine. It's 1:52. Settlement prices are in. Let's go to Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, and good Monday afternoon, everyone. Quite a day at the Chicago Board of Trade and in Kansas City, where there was a lot of green on the screen, except in one notable place, and that is the corn pit. Talk of huge acres, potentially, for the prospective planting reports to be released at the end of the month next Wednesday. Put a lid on that particular marketplace. We'll have to discuss all the particulars during the closing market report this afternoon at 2:06 with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat, a high of the day of 499, a low of 490.5, settlement at 494 up to July, a high of 510.5, a low of 503, settlement at 505, also up two on the day. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 492.75, a low of 482.25, settlement 486.5, up 2.75. July, a high of 505.25, a low of 494.75, settlement 499, up 2.5. December wheat, a high of 546.25, a low of 535.5, settlement 540.75, up 2.75, and we'll take it on out to March of 2011. A high of 570.25, a low of 563.5, settlement at 566, up 2.5 on the day. May corn, a high of 378.25. That, by the way, come close to last week's high. Just couldn't get over the hump. A low of 370.5, settlement at 370.75, down 3.75. July, a high of 387, a low of 381.5, settlement 381.75, down 3.75. September, a high of 395.25, a low of 390. The settlement on its low for the day, down 4. December corn, a high of 404.75, a low of 398.75, settlement 399.25, down 4.25. March of 2011, a high of 414.5, a low of 409.75, settlement 410, down 4.25. May, a high of 420.5, the high, the low 417.75, settlement at 417, down 4.5. July of 2011, corn, a high of 427.75, a low of 423, settlement 422.5, down 4.5. Go out a year to the harvest month, December of 2011, a high of 422, a low of 418, settlement 417.75, down 4.25 on the day. Mayotte's, a high of 225, a low of 218, settlement 218 and a half, down 6. The July contract also down 6 on the day. The high there at 233 and a half, the low at 227, and it settled on its low at 227. May beans, a high of 975, a low of 958 and a half, settlement 968 and a half, up 6 3/4. July, a high of 982 and 3/4, a low of 984 and a quarter, settlement 976 and 3/4, up 7 1/4. August beans, a high of 978 and a half, a low of 961, settlement 973 and a quarter, up 7 1/4. November, a high of 949 and a quarter, a low of 935 and a half, settlement 945 and 3/4, up 3 3/4. January of 2011, a high of 957, a low of 944 and a quarter, settlement 953 and 3/4, up 3 1/2. Let's go out to November of 2011, a high of 967, a low of 955, settlement at 964 and a quarter, up 2 3/4 on the day. May soybean meal, a high of 273.70, a low of 268.10, settlement 271.40, up $1.20. July, a high of 272.50, a low of 267.30, settlement at 270.40, up 90 cents. May soybean oil, a high of 39.80, a low of 39.12, settlement 39.72, up 42. July, a high of 40.23, a low of 39.54, settlement 40.15, up 42 cents on the day. Settlement prices are also in from CME Livestock. We'll have those in just one moment. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Taking a look now at the settlements on CME Livestock. April live cattle, the high was 98.20, the low 96.62 and a half. It settled at 97.10. That is down 0.87 and a half. June live cattle, the high price 95.30, the low 93.75, settling at 94.07 and a half, and that was down 1.05. For August live cattle, the high price was 92.47 and a half, the low 90.90, settling at 91.30. The change was down 1.17 and a half. Feeder cattle for March, the high price was 105.40, the low 104.40, settling at 104.70, down 10. And 0.10, that is. 109.05 was the high price for April feeder cattle. The low price was 107.10, settling at 107.45, and that was down 1.22 and a half. Lean hogs for April, 73.90 was the high. The low, 72.90, settling at 73.10. It was down 0.25. May lean hogs at 80.34, the high. The low was 79.35, settling at 79.85, with a change down 0.05. And for pork bellies, frozen pork bellies for March 20th, not a full listing here, 92.50 for the high, settling at 91.50, no change. Pork bellies for May 20th, 95 was the high, 93 the low, settling at 93.15. The change was down 0.32 and a half. It's 2 o'clock, and this is